Minutes past the hour, 12:08 lunchtime, which means it's time for the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm Elise Glink, sitting in for John today. Actually, I'll be here all week talking about money and, at least in this hour, money, real estate, and all things. Feel free to call in with your questions. You know, happy to do that. 781-981-7200, 312-981-7200. 4 hours on the air. This is hour four for me anyway. So markets, this was a crazy morning for the stock market again. You know, we started off with down over 600 points. We're now down only 25 points in the Dow. NASDAQ is up, as you heard. S&P is up. And really, the concerns that people have, I always wonder when I look at sites like CNBC or CNN, I'm starting to think for the day about what this means. You know, that everybody's looking for a reason for the stock market to behave as it's behaving. And even I, you know, well, why is it down 600 points today? What happened over the weekend to make it go down 600 points? And what do I do about my own investments? Which I think is at the bottom line where it is. And last week, I heard Jim Cramer from CNBC talking a little bit about that he thinks this big game is going on with the stock market and that he expects the market to go down significantly. Now, Cramer is right as often as he is wrong. So, you know, he's not exactly like anybody. Nobody has a crystal ball. Prognostications are just that. They're guesses at what may happen. And certainly when you look for reasons in the stock market, it's really hard right now to figure anything out because you can certainly say that, well, the market went down today, and this is what they said in the beginning, because traders are now worried about rising COVID infections in the South and the Southeast as companies have begun to return to work. Sounds reasonable. Okay, so what happened in the last 4 hours? Because it's not like we had fewer infections in the last 4 hours, and in fact, we're almost at 8 million cases globally with, you know, over 400,000 deaths confirmed, which in my mind is nowhere near being over. And certainly we're seeing all kinds of things come up. So clearly that wasn't the reason that the markets, you know, did this little dance. So I think at the end of the day, you know, as you think about how stock markets, you know, go down and come back, there's been such a change in the last 10 years because the Federal Reserve has basically committed to putting as much money as it can, as much money as it has to, into supporting businesses. And at the end of last week, they made what I have to say was quite the pronouncement. They said that no matter how long it took, they didn't see raising interest rates anytime soon, maybe not till 2022 or later, that they would continue to buy all kinds of debt and look for other ways to support the economy. So what does that tell me? If I'm a trader, it tells me, great, we've got zero interest rates or lower, but you could get negative from now until I can even think. So that means, you know, we're going to buy into the stock market. So to me, that's why the stock market is up, no matter what, you know, these little bumps in the road. But when I look at what it says about the economy, and when the Fed comes out and says this is a rough road and we're only at the beginning of it, and it's going to take a long time to get 20 million people, you know, off of unemployment and back in the jobs, that we need to support as much as we can, that makes me worry for all of us, people, not stocks, not the stock market, not traders and not billionaires. I'm worried about the rest of us who are trying to figure out what we're going to do when unemployment runs out. We heard from the government over the weekend that the extra $600 a week the people who are unemployed have been getting, which ends July 31st, is likely not to be extended, and instead they're going to give maybe a one-time payment, a reduced payment, to say, okay, this is it, go back to work, as if there are 20 million jobs out there, and there aren't. So it'll be interesting to see what happens as we move into the third quarter of the year, you know, July, August, September, and people try to get back to real life, and real life isn't there. And so I look at the stock market as being this completely divergent from reality. It's not telling me what the world is going to look like in 9 months. It almost is aspirational. Here's what I hope the world would be like in 9 months. But to me, that isn't anything to hang your hat on. All right. It is 12:17 at the moment, and this is the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm Elise Glink. So glad you're here filling in for John this week. You can find me at bestmoneymoves.com. Find out more about financial wellness there as well. We write about it all the time. Jim Dulkey is the senior editor of Chicago Inno, AmericanInno.com. He joins us now, as he does every Monday, with the news of the week in business and all the things going on. Hey, Jim, welcome back.
Hey, Elise, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
It's nice to have you on this side of the microphone again. So let's dig in. There's just all kinds of news going on this week. Let's start with Just Eat, which is buying Grubhub for over $7 billion. I thought they were going to Uber.
That's right. It certainly seemed that way. So for weeks, you know, the talk has been, you know, Grubhub and Uber in very close conversations, nearing a deal, getting close to a deal. But it turns out a European delivery giant ended up stealing the deal. So JustEatTakeaway.com announced last week that it's come to terms with Grubhub for about $7.3 billion. And yeah, it is a bit of a surprise because, you know, really for weeks and months, actually, you know, Grubhub and Uber were in talks for an acquisition. And, you know, it appears to be a couple of reasons why that sort of fizzled. But one really, you know, kind of appears to be antitrust concerns. It doesn't look like regulators were going to be, you know, really in favor of a deal where two large American delivery companies were going to combine. And so, you know, I think for Grubhub, they're seeing, you know, potentially an easier path to getting this deal actually finalized with a European company. So, you know, for Just Eat, what they got was, you know, a profitable food delivery business in America and their first entrance into the U.S. And so, you know, for them, they got a business in Grubhub that, you know, is going to potentially grow even further and hopefully gain some market share back from DoorDash and Uber and companies like that, where it's lost a little bit of its lead. But, you know, and for Grubhub now, they are going to still be based in Chicago. They're going to be the North American headquarters for JustEatTakeaway.com. So still kind of to be determined what this means for the growth of Grubhub long term in terms of the number of local jobs and continued investment in its Chicago HQ. But for right now, you know, it seems to be a win for Grubhub.
So what's interesting to me is that you've got Just Eat Takeout was actually also a merger earlier this year. I mean, these lawyers behind this company must be going, really? We just finished a big one for you guys, because it was a company called Just Eat and a company called Takeaway. And they merged an $11.1 billion deal. And we should point out that this $7.3 billion deal to buy Grubhub is actually, isn't it a stock swap or a complete stock?
Yeah, it's an all-stock deal. So, yeah, so it's a complete stock deal. And at the time, gave kind of Grubhub shares had an implied value of about $75 a share. So, yeah, it's an interesting story here because, you know, Just Eat, based in the U.K., Takeaway.com, based in the Netherlands, they merged like you mentioned, an $11.1 billion deal. So now, you know, just months from that, have acquired an American company, and it really kind of shows you, you know, the momentum that we're seeing in the food delivery space, and certainly, you know, on the backs of the coronavirus here, as people continue to double down on food delivery, certainly comes at an interesting time.
Yeah, and frankly, global stock markets zooming have helped this and many other deals actually come to fruition because there's actually more juice in the marketplace. Let's turn now to Tax Proper. This is a new startup helping homeowners lower their property taxes. They've just raised $2 million to kind of kickstart their raise and their work. So tell us what they do.
Yeah, so Tax Proper is really, you know, kind of taking a really interesting approach, sort of appealing your property tax bill. And so, a lot of people, want to get their property tax bill appealed, but maybe they don't know exactly how to do that. And a tax preparer is taking all the complexities out of that. So, they will help you appeal your property tax rates by using their pretty simple algorithm. So they'll take your address, and they'll take a look at what similar homes nearby you have been assessed at, taking into account things like the size, the number of stories, the construction materials, and they will help you appeal your tax bill on your behalf. And so, they charge either a $150 fee or 30% of your first year's savings, and you only pay if you actually end up getting a lower tax bill. So really kind of like this idea. It actually reminded me of a similar business that has an approach with your cable bill. They'll call Comcast on your behalf and kind of renegotiate your bill for you. I sort of like these ideas of virtual assistants kind of coming in here and taking a kind of cumbersome, very document-heavy approach and sort of taking all the legwork out for you and doing it on your behalf. So, yeah, Tax Proper just last week raised $2 million to help grow its business. A couple of interesting leaders behind that, a former mayor, Lori Lightfoot, administrative staff, and a former statistician for State Farm. So a couple of smart folks leading up that interesting new Chicago startup.
Yeah, I love the fact that it's got a really local sort of focus to it, and that people really are here and they've worked through the Chicago property tax system, which, well, frankly, Cook County is just unlike any other county in just about the world. But it's going to be good and be interesting to see. And there are just, for comparison purposes, they actually have set up their fee structure similarly to the way attorneys here charge right now to contest property taxes, which is typically about a third of the first year savings and then nothing going further. So anyway, good luck to them. Hopefully that'll work out. There's another startup called 4Degrees. I'm always interested in artificial intelligence. My older son is getting a PhD in that right now, so I'm always looking for things that can help me be smarter when I talk to him. Tell me about this company.
Yeah, so 4Degrees is a really interesting business. It's founded actually by a couple of former investors at Pritzker Group Venture Capital. And so these two founders kind of went from the investor side to the founder side and launched 4Degrees as an AI startup that helps you kind of better leverage your professional network. They build an AI tool that helps you kind of better understand your personal and professional connections and build stronger relationships. And it focuses on industries like venture capital and commercial real estate, investment banking, kind of helping you find the right connections that you should focus on, given what kind of business moves you need to make. And so really interesting, a professional networking tool that they've created. And just last week, the business announced that it has raised some funding from Harlem Capital, which is a New York-based VC firm, which is really known for investing in diverse founders. Their goal when they launched their debut fund last year was to invest in 1,000 diverse founders over the next 20 years. And so, what's really interesting about this is, the company 4Degrees is founded by Ablordea Shigbe, which is a founder of color and here in Chicago. And, the founding for 4Degrees, really sort of comes now at a time when, Chicago's tech community and startup ecosystems across the country are coming under increased scrutiny for a lack of diversity. I've been covering Chicago tech and startups for the last 6 years, and I can probably count the number of venture rounds raised by Black founders on two hands. It's really kind of an embarrassment, I think, on the city of Chicago that more Black founders have not raised funding. And so it was certainly, interesting to see 4Degrees continue to get some momentum and continue to get some funding. But, us at Chicago, we'll be certainly keeping our eye out to see, how can Chicago's investment community continue to diversify their portfolios and continue to invest in founders of color.
I think it's really important to invest in founders of color. It's important to invest in women. There are still so few women, and even the smallest group is probably women of color when it comes to startups and raising capital. And as somebody who has tried to raise capital and has spent I've spent a lot of time over the last couple of years talking to different VC groups across the country, it is incredibly difficult if you don't already have a huge amount of capital, or you're not getting that sort of monthly run rate to a place where they want it. And even when you get it there, then they say, I'm sorry, we meant to add an extra zero. So the hurdles are high, and anything that can help these companies, you know, get started and stay in business long enough to be successful, I think is terrific.
Absolutely. You know, just about 1% of all venture capital goes to African-American founders, which is absurdly low. And, you know, as you mentioned, black females have an even harder time. I think it's about 0.2% of all venture capital goes to African-American women. So lots of work to be done on that front.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad to see it. There's another startup in Chicago, Jurnera. Am I pronouncing that correctly? Tell me a little bit about that.
That's right.
Jurnera.
Yeah, so Jurnera is a really interesting kind of travel business in Chicago, and you know, that just last week they raised a little over $11 million in a new funding round, which is very interesting because, you know, we're seeing lots of travel businesses be hit really hard because of the coronavirus, especially kind of like the early stage startup space. So lots of companies are having a really difficult time, but Jurnera just raised a new round of funding from Andreessen Horowitz, co-led the round. So big-name Silicon Valley investor re-upping an investment in Jurnera. And you know what Jurnera does is kind of help create a more seamless travel experience for a passenger. So, for example, Jurnera works with kind of travel and hospitality companies throughout the duration of somebody's trip. And so, for example, they can automatically rebook your rental car reservation if your flight was canceled for weather, or they can make sure your hotel room is ready early in the morning if your flight lands early in the day and you need to get to the hotel. And so one thing that they're able to do for the user is kind of create a more seamless travel experience. And then for the companies that they work with, it's all about data. So they work with companies like United Airlines and Hilton and Marriott, really kind of creating an end-to-end travel data sharing experience between all those companies. And the really interesting thing about Jurnera specifically is that they're led by Jeffrey Katz, which is the founder of Orbitz.
So somebody who actually has a lot of experience in building a successful company in the travel space, which is helpful.
Totally, yeah. So, I mean, it's interesting here, too, that, you know, all the investors that were a part of the company's previous round, and they're all back as well. So that counts Pritzker Group, Mr. Capital here in Chicago as well. So it's interesting to see a travel startup. And, it's not all doom and gloom for travel businesses out there. Jurnera is seeing some opportunity ahead.
Well, it's kind of a rough ride. I know that the travel companies are working really, really hard to get everybody to feel like they can go and travel again. And in fact, I think, what did they say, last month, travel was up, 17% from the month before, but it's still, way far behind last year. I don't know. I have to say, as somebody who travels a lot, Jurnera sounds like the kind of company that could be really helpful. And we'll see. Best of luck to them. Jim, thank you so much for being with us today. Jim Dulkey is senior editor, Chicago Inno. You can find out more at AmericanInno.com, INNO/Chicago. Thanks. We really appreciate you being with us.
Thanks, Lise.
It's 12:32. I'm Elise Glink sitting in for John today. You can find me at bestmoneymoves.com. Feel free to link into me as well. Always happy to chat with our listeners. Greg McBride is Senior Vice President, Chief Financial Analyst for Bankrate.com. Bankrate provides analysis and advice on personal finance and also bank rates, which is where they got their start. Hey, Greg, I am so excited to have you on the show today.
To chat with you again, Elise.
I know.
Thank you.
This is so fun to do it on the radio instead of just, on regular telephone lines like we normally do. So, let's start with, the stock market has had just this incredible comeback today. And last week we had the Fed, tell us that basically interest rates are going to be zero for a long time. What does that mean for consumers, do you think?
Well, I think for the borrower side of the equation, I think it's a nice boost to the housing market. Mortgage rates are at record lows. That puts some wind in the sails of home buyers from an affordability standpoint. The other thing we're seeing now is, as different states open up, is that spring buying season that didn't happen in the spring, it's happening now. And so you've got a lot of pent-up demand and compressed activity taking place right now with the benefit of those low mortgage rates. So I think, housing is actually going to be definitely an engine of growth for the economy. at least over the next 12 months. I think we get a real sense of where the housing market is 12 months from now when the forbearance programs begin to expire, and then we kind of got to see where we are from an economic standpoint. But, you know, we see low rates for other borrowers, too. Credit card rates are at a four-year low. Home equity lines of credit, those rates below 5% on average. That's also the lowest in about 4 years. So borrowers definitely have some wind at their back, whether they're trying to pay down debt or they're looking to borrow for some reason.
Yeah, well, we'll have to see if home buyers actually have anything that they can buy, right? Because right now we're just seeing that there might be, you know, they might be out there and they might be willing. And interest rates, I think, did I read, also fell below 3% for a 30-year mortgage?
There are some sub 3% quotes out there. You know, we see 3% even with no points. So, you know, yes, wow. I mean, just rates that are unheard of. I mean, you know, we thought 4% was something we'd never see ever again, and rates have just managed to fall even lower than that. But yeah, you know, that the sort of the boogeyman for the housing market for so long has just been the lack of available supply. You can't buy it if it's not for sale, and too many would-be home buyers just haven't been able to find homes for sale. And that problem appears to be even more accentuated right now. With, you know, the pandemic, you know, people have been reluctant to put their homes on the market. They don't really want strangers traipsing through the living room. So I think, you know, again, a lot of that supply that was already constrained, even more so now.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think we're going to start. I have people. It's interesting. You know, my husband is a real estate attorney, and things were just completely quiet here in Chicago for a long time. And then all of a sudden, in the last few weeks, deals are starting to come in. But what he said, which was really interesting, and of course he's been a real estate attorney for a long time, is that buyers today are very nervous. At the first sign of trouble, they're, hey, we're going to just back out of this deal and go find a different house, as if there's just an unlimited number of houses out there. So we're seeing houses move, which is great for Chicago, which has really lagged. But buyers are nervous. Sellers are nervous that it may not work out right. I think brokers are a little bit nervous. This uncertainty, I think, is really getting in the way of the recovery.
And lenders are nervous, too. You know, we talk about low interest rates, but we'd be remiss if we didn't acknowledge the fact that credit has tightened. Lenders, you know, they are nervous. They're limiting their risk exposure. In a lot of cases, they're doing their version of social distancing. You know, they're dealing with existing customers, not necessarily out recruiting new business, not looking to let strangers into the house. And so, yes, rates may be at the lowest level we've seen in, you know, in case of mortgage rates, lowest ever, in case of some of these other borrowing rates, the lowest we've seen in years. But the circle of borrowers that can actually take advantage of that is smaller as credit has tightened, and particularly as we see unemployment rising.
And let's talk about that for a moment, because the credit, you know, is tightening at the time that people might need it the most. And I mean, with HELOCs, home equity lines of credit, you know, I'm seeing in the reports that I get from mortgage bankers is that banks are really worried about people borrowing huge sums of money on their HELOCs and then, of course, leaving their job or getting separated from their companies or laid off or furloughed. We're also seeing credit card companies limit the lines of credit that people have. What are you guys seeing in terms of both the interest rates that are being charged, points and fees, but also the shutting down of HELOCs?
So, yeah, those credit trends, that you hit the nail on the head. And this is symptomatic of a recession. We saw this during the financial crisis. Lenders very quick to limit their exposure. In the case of credit card issuers, they lend on an unsecured basis. It's typically the first debt that gets discharged in a bankruptcy. And so they really live on the leading edge of credit risk. And so we often see credit card issuers moving very quickly to close down unused credit cards. That card you've had stuck in a drawer for 2 years and you haven't used it, card issuers very quick to shut that down, because what are the chances you're going to pull that card out and start using it with some sort of regularity and be a profitable customer and not be in some sort of financial distress? And so card issuers very quick to limit that risk. They cut existing credit lines as a way of limiting their exposure. And we see something similar on home equity lines as well. Cutting credit lines to limit their exposure, which is why this may be a supplement to your emergency savings, but it's not your go-to for emergency savings, simply because when times are lean and you're most likely to need that money is the time when lenders are most likely to be trimming their risk exposure, and they could freeze your credit line. They could, you know, cut back the credit line to limit their exposure. So, you know, we see both of those. And then we also see a lot of lenders moving away from home equity lines, either really raising the bar, only lending to existing customers, or setting a higher threshold on credit scores, or they're just focusing on the first mortgage business because refinancing demand has just been off the charts with interest rates at record lows.
Yeah, no, it is really interesting. I get a lot of letters from people who are saying that they're seeing their credit scores go down, and I think this limiting of credit is really part and parcel of what's going on. I think there's some other issues that are going on as well, but what many people don't realize is when you shut down a line of credit or a credit card shuts it down or they reduce the line of credit and you actually have a balance on it, it can easily change your debt ratio, right? The debt to credit limit ratio, which is sort of the crux of how, you know, a core component, let's say, of your credit score. And I know that this happened even to me, that my oldest piece of credit, which is a credit card that I've had for more than 20 years, I got a letter saying, you haven't used us in a while, and if you don't use us, we're going to shut you down. And immediately that night, I went out and used it, because if I got my longest piece of credit shut down, I know enough about credit scores knowing that that would really factor in. And are you seeing that out there? Are you guys seeing, you know, just kind of the effect of this on people's credit?
That it is the second biggest component of your credit score, that debt to available credit ratio. So between that and making your payments on time, together, that's two-thirds of your credit score. So if you make your payments on time and keep your debts modest relative to your available credit, I mean, you know, that you're halfway, you're two-thirds of the way home in terms of a good credit score. And yes, to your point, when issuers are closing out credit lines, when they're cutting credit limits, all of a sudden, through no fault of your own, that can push your debt to available credit ratio higher. If it gets above 30%, either in aggregate or even on any one card, that can start to ding your credit score. So to have the best effects, you ideally want to keep that below 10% of your available credit. And that goes even if you're paying your balance in full every month, the statement balance that gets reported to the credit bureaus. Even if you're paying it in full, you want to make sure that statement balance is ideally below 10% of your available credit, because that's where it has a positive effect on your score. If it's below 30%, you're not doing damage to your score. It's when it gets above 30%, that's when you start to see this impacting your score. And to your point, I think we are starting to see the effects of these credit lines being reined in and closed out, because those debt to available credit ratios nosing above that 30% mark, and some people seeing some dings to their credit score as a result.
That's great advice. Greg McBride is Senior Vice President and Chief Financial Analyst for Bankrate.com. Thanks so much for being with us. Steve, what about the business
well,
news?
Well, the Dow had erased a 760-point drop and moved into positive territory, but just briefly, it's now down 76 points. The NASDAQ has stayed in positive territory, up 54 after starting out lower, and the S&P 500 just slipped into negative territory, down about a point and a half.
And for the agribusiness markets, Orion?
Well, we're looking at a screen with not much change in the agricultural markets. The July wheat contract is up a quarter of a cent a bushel. July corn contract down a penny and a half a bushel. July soybeans down 3.25 cents a bushel. Livestock futures, Chicago Mercantile Exchange, the July lean hog contract is trading higher. It's up 67 cents a hundredweight. The August live cattle market up 55 cents. And the August feeder cattle contract is down 15 cents a hundredweight. Right. A hundredweight. And China back in the U.S. soybean market again today. Private exporters reported the sale of 390,000 tons of soybeans to China for delivery in the 2020 to 21 marketing year. That report from the USDA this morning. Meanwhile, the pandemic continues to play havoc with outdoor summer farm shows, county fairs, and state fairs. again, a reminder that state fairs in Indiana and in Iowa and in Wisconsin, and add to that Illinois over the weekend. Governor Pritzker said no Illinois state fair, so all of those state fairs postponed till next year. But there's one that isn't. The governor of Missouri, Mike Parson, says some sort of the Missouri State Fair will be held in August. He said, as an ag governor, I guess I want to say somebody that comes from a farm, I don't want it to be the second time the Missouri State Fair has been canceled, because the other state fairs were generally canceled back in World War II at the end of the war in 1945. But Governor Mike Parson of Missouri said, not under my watch. So at this point, there will be a Missouri State Fair. And the county fairs that are being impacted by this are coming up with some unique ideas. The Lake County Fairgrounds, that's Lake County, Illinois, has announced that you can replace the drive-in movie super screen with a grandstand stage, stellar acoustics, big-name local cover bands, and cars of every make, model, and sort, and you'll have a cool live music concert at the Lake County Fairgrounds. I think there are seven of them there, and they'll do 2 75-minute shows, one at 4 p.m. and one at 7 p.m. daily, from Thursday, June 25th through Sunday, June 28th. And you can send an email to the Lake County Fairgrounds, lcfair.com, to get the full schedule of the cover bands that will be appearing at this live music concert on the fairgrounds. One other way to get around the big change that county and state fairs, as well as outdoor fairs, and yes, let me say again, the sandwich fair, because I keep getting emails asking about the sandwich fair. In the middle of July, they're going to make their decision on whether or not there will be a sandwich fair. If it's going to take place, it would be the weekend after Labor Day in September, and we'll keep you posted on what's going to happen with the sandwich fair. That's your money on 720 WGN.
It is 12:50 on the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm Elise Glink, sitting in for John today. Amy Guth, WGN reporter, joins us now. Hey, Amy.
Hey, how are you today? Happy Monday.
Happy Monday. It's going to be, I hope, a good week for everybody. So United borrowed $5 billion against its frequent flyer program. You mean all those miles that nobody's been able to use because nobody wants to go anywhere?
Yeah, those. That's the one. Yeah, that's exactly it. As you know, and as I'm sure, you know, we've all been hearing a lot about, John and I have been talking about this. I feel like almost every day there's a new airline update, but I keep a close eye on United because they're local. So they've borrowed $5 million against the frequent flyer program. And a lot of this has to, if it also borrows $4.5 billion from the federal government, which it says it plans to do, it'll have about $17 billion in liquidity by the end of the third quarter. Now, the reason that is needed, because it looks like, oh, here's this airline just stockpiling cash, the reason that will be needed is because they say they expect to burn an average of $40 million a day in the second quarter and $30 million a day in the third quarter, which is almost, you know, an unfathomably big number to go through in a day. But that's what we're looking at in terms of, you know, how bad the airlines have been hit. They are projecting that revenue, April, it was down 98% from the year prior. They say June revenue will be about 90%, July down 82% to 88%. So, I mean, these are major, major hits, of course, that airlines took. They are, you know, they acknowledge, hey, travel is coming back. But I think the other thing they're bracing for is through that, through some of that federal funding, part of that will only get them through September 30th to cover payroll. So they've also, you know, there's starting to be conversation about, okay, what happens with our workers? In the white collar positions that have already taken some voluntary severance, things like that. So it's really a lot on airlines right now. But what's kind of interesting is, or unique about this move, is that what they did in the past, instead of borrowing against the frequent flyer program, they would just sell miles off in advance. You know, that's a pretty lucrative way to build up some cash reserves, because so many big companies, like, think about your credit card where you can, like, get miles for stuff. So credit card companies and banks will buy these miles to give them for loyalty and rewards and things like that. So they usually sell them in advance. So they shifted this time to borrow against it because it will let them run the program with fewer restrictions than they would have against them with an advance sale, and it won't hit the revenue down the road, which they would do if they would do it the traditional way. So this is not an unexpected move, but it's certainly, they've approached it in a different way than they have in the past. But it really just kind of points to how badly the airline carriers have been hit by this crisis.
Yeah, I mean, I think you really have to say, and I think your point is exactly right, are they going to be laying off people when the government money ends in September? This is an indication that they don't want to lay off those people, which is good, right? Who wants more layoffs? We've certainly had we're awash in layoffs. But how are they going to make that actually happen? And then it makes me think about United being so very underwater with all of these different loan programs. But, you know, all the airlines are going to be in that situation, and we're just going to have to see what happens. All right, so Quibi, they're also not doing so great. Tell us about them.
I'm really fascinated by this company. Even Scott Catoon and I were talking about this months and months ago on the air, right there on WGN Radio, about this really interesting company, Quibi. And the idea was, hey, everybody is so darn busy, let's make really short programming that's made for mobile viewing. This idea that everyone's so busy, we're out in the world doing these things. And I thought, hey, that's pretty interesting, a 9-minute sitcom, or, binge watching 9 or 10 minutes at a time. That's kind of an interesting idea. So big heavy hitters at the helm, a ton of funding. They launched in early April with about $1.75 billion in funding.
Wow.
They have been talking
months. Let's just stop there and go,
yeah.
Wow, wow.
Right.
You have almost $2 billion in funding. Wow.
That's
and
right.
It is Jeffrey Katzenberg and Meg Whitman, we should say. So they are big heavy hitters, as you say, but man, that is a lot of cash.
Right. So here's like two people who, by all accounts, have a great track record and know what the heck they're doing. So they get this huge funding. For months and months and months, people were talking about Quibi, who was going to be on it. We saw some really kind of clever commercials come out. Chrissy Teigen had a spot in one of them. A lot of, very recognizable faces had programming there, and it was such an interesting idea. Well, it's not going so well. So their target of 7.4 million subscribers by the end of the year, so far they've got about 4 million downloads. And so, the New York Times said that might be a little closer to 5 million, so there's some discrepancy between that. But still, it's not 7.4 million. And it's really, really struggling. They offered a 90-day trial, and it still just kind of remains to be seen if they're translating into paying customers. So what the leadership has come out and said, Jeffrey Katzenberg and Meg Whitman, they've come and said, this is really about behavioral change due to COVID, and that we live in these pivotal and unprecedented times as, more people, we're not out in the world scrambling around looking at our phones as much. We're home looking at bigger screens. There's also civil unrest going where some of the programming might not land in the same way, right? So they're saying, hey, this may not have been the best time for this.
But Amy, don't you think it's also, how many more subscriptions can we have? Like, Sam and I just, started with Hulu because we wanted to watch Catherine the Great, which is, by the way,
yep,
hilarious.
So and good, yeah.
So good. On every level, so good. And then we've got Amazon, so we watch stuff on there, and then we've got Netflix, and but how many more could we actually really consume? And I think people are kind of, you're seeing, if you look at the credit trends, you see people are spending less on these. They're spending a lot in digital subscriptions, but do you need one more?
Yeah, I have the same question. I think what was interesting and kind of what had some hopes up about Quibi was this idea of saying, hey, let's stop programming for the sitcom length show or, 22 to 48 minutes like we have since the television was invented. Let's do something specific to mobile, these tiny little bite-sized pieces of a show. And I think that was exciting to people. But then I think 2020 happened, right? The world kind of changed and behavior went with it. So I think it'll be really interesting to see if they survive. There was so much optimism about them. I mean, when that story, when that announcement first happened of, hey, this is this thing we are building and it's going to be huge, yeah. It was really fascinating. I mean, so many tech blogs and entertainment blogs were just going berserk.
Yeah, hype and versus reality, another clash craziness.
Yep.
Amy, thank you so much for that. We will talk to you again soon. Amy Guth is WGN's reporter and woman on the street with all kinds of great stuff. I'm Elise Klink. I'll be back tomorrow.